Good morning, afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome. This is a change of pace. Usually the classes that I give are text-based. They tend to be either biblical in nature or Talmudic, Midrashic, or certainly rabbinic in nature. The class usually revolves around some relatively intricate, either literary, linguistic, or theological explanation. We will be doing text this time. We'll be looking at the texts of many of the songs that were sung by the early chalutzim, by the pioneers, in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, up to the early years, let's say the first decade of the after the establishment of the State of Israel. I have to draw the line someplace. So we will be looking at some texts, but clearly not with the intensity with which we have previously examined more classic texts. So since as a segue then, let me begin by sharing with you a pasuk and a rashi. When you think of Hebrew songs or Jewish songs in the Tanakh, two things come to mind. One I rejected out of hand because it's a bit negative. That, of course, is the famous line in Psalm 137 on the Harod Bavel, where our enemies and tormentors said to us, Shiru lanu mishir tzion. Exactly what the Shir Tzion was is a matter of some debate amongst the Parshanim. Seems to be a consensus, though not necessarily a unanimity, that it refers to the songs, the Mizmorim of Tehillim, that were sung by the Leviim in Beit HaMikdash, but it could very well refer to other songs as well. So I put that aside on account of its, as I said, it's somewhat negative context, and chose this one instead. When Father Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, dispatches his sons back to Egypt, not the first time, but the second time, he tells them, "Kchu mizimrat ha'aretz b'kleichem." And as you see, the standard translation of zimrat ha'aretz are things that are most praiseworthy of the land. What these things were is explicit. He says, ma'at sori, ma'at vash, right? Some balsam, some honey, spices, pistachios, almonds, right? Almost as though it were Tu Bishvat, which of course it was just yesterday. So these are the Zimrat Ha'aretz. Clearly the reference is to fruits and nuts, meaning that even during a famine, there were certain things that continued to grow, at least during the early years of the famine. And Yaakov is suggesting that perhaps in order to mollify, to pacify the ruler of Egypt who was making things difficult for his children, that he would make a gesture to send him something. But the question is, why are these things called Zimrat Ha'aretz? What connection do they have to Zion Mem Resh? Now, I must tell you that what Rashi says is lovely, and we're going to proceed on that basis, right? Rashi says that Zimrat Ha'aretz was understood correctly by the Targum, by Onkelos, who translated it as Mishavach Ha'aretz, things that people praise, hence the English translation, right? But then he says, why are such things called Zimra? Shehakol Nizamrin Alav Kishahu Ba La'olam. That when these things come into existence, that is to say, when these trees bear the fruit or when these nuts grow, right, that people sing their praises. So indeed, Zimrat Ha'aretz are things that are praiseworthy, but they're praiseworthy particularly in the way that people sing about them. Between you and me, just parenthetically, I don't think that's the pshat. I think that the pshat would recognize that the word zimora is an agricultural term. It refers to a branch of a vine. and that there's a verb, lizamer, which is to tend to things horticulturally. So it may very well be that the pshat of Zimrat Haaretz is that it is clearly a reference to things that grow on trees, that grow on branches, and that have to be harvested. But we'll just take the drash of Rashi at face value, and we're going to devote our attention in the coming weeks to the songs of the land of Israel. And here are just a list of the possibilities. I don't know that we're going to have the opportunity to cover all of these, and this certainly isn't an exclusive list. If at any time you would like us to draw our attention to some song that was a particular favorite of yours, then by all means, either put it in the chat or drop it in an email to me, and I'll do my best to be able to add it to our curriculum. But as you can see, I've divided the songs reasonably into four categories. I call the first category first words, and that is the according to the historical records, these are the earliest songs sung by pioneers in the land of Israel, at least of which we have some historical or literary record. Now, obviously, people could have been singing for, you know, long before the first Aliyah. People in the land of Israel could have been singing even long before the Biluyim came in the middle of the 19th century. But insofar as we have an historical or literary record of Hebrew songs, then these that I've called first words are the earliest songs on record. Okay? The second category I called fighting words. I call them fighting words because these are songs that are born of conflict. They're born either of the First World War or of the Second World War or of the above ground and underground struggles against the Arabs, against the British. And of course, if we enter into the first decade of the existence of the State of Israel, born as well of the experience of the Milchemet Ha'atzma'ut, Israel's War of Independence. The third category I call Love of Land. And those are songs that focus on particular places in the land of Israel or that sing the virtues of the land of Israel in general. And the last category I call religious Zionism, or even as you see the parentheses, anti-religious Zionism. Those are songs that were born either of religious youth organizations, such as B'nai Akiva, or occasionally of anti-religious youth organizations. So we'll look at those as well. And then there was a song that was simply one of the favorites of mine, and I couldn't fit it neatly into any of the four categories. So in honor of Zemer Nuga, I created a fifth category called Everything Else. So as I said, just as I, as you can reasonably expect, am going to introduce some of my favorite songs, I said, you're all invited if you wish to let me know of what were some of your favorite songs and just do my best to try to get them into our curriculum. So with that introduction aside, we can move directly to the earliest song of which there is either an historical or a literary record. Just to fill you in on what you see here, every one of the songs on the source sheets has the full text of the words of the song, but there's also, as you see at the beginning, there's a link. Okay? If you're unacquainted with this website, the website, as you can see, is called Zemer Reshet, right? Reshet is a station. Zemer is a song. And it's .co.il. So this is a website that's maintained in Israel, specifically for the purpose of preserving Hebrew songs. And the website contains the texts of the songs. It contains, if there's available, some information about the composer, about the lyricist, but more to the point, it contains, in most cases, several recordings of the song on the part of either well-known or unknown Israeli or other Jewish entertainers. Okay, So if we look at this earliest song, El Yivneh HaGalil, okay, the background, it seems to date, or at least it's the earliest date to which it can be located historically, is 1884. In 1884, the Baron Rothschild established a silk weaving workshop in Rosh Pina. And since the work was difficult, he had to hire workers. And apparently one of the workers who arrived in Rosh Pina to work in the silk weaving workshop came from Lebanon. Nobody really knows exactly what his name is. It's come down in the historical records as Chatzbani. The Chatzbani is the name of a river in Lebanon, as well as the name of a town in Lebanon. It could very well be that that was his family name, or it could simply be that he was called the Chatzbani, just as nowadays we might call somebody a New Yorker. Okay. And again, according to the meager historical evidence that we have, he taught this song to the other workers in the factory, having brought the song with him from his ancestral home in Lebanon, along with a tradition that the song had originated actually in the 16th century, when, if you're really up to date on your history of the land of Israel, there was an attempt, unsuccessful ultimately, to reestablish some sort of Jewish settlement, specifically in the city of Tveria, under the auspices of the Duke of Naxos, Don Yosef Nasi, and under the patronage of his aunt, Dona Gracia Nasi. If you visit Tveria, you will certainly encounter either actual remnants of this settlement attempt, or at least local folklore about it. So again, what we have here is a song that, according to the tradition that that brought it in to Israel in the late 19th century, has its roots in earlier attempts to settle or to colonize the land of Israel. And if you click on the link, this is what you're going to get. I'll just simply take us to it. And you can look at the words either, if you look at the words, follow it, you can follow along with the tune. You just tell me, do you, whether you hear it? Somebody give me a thumbs up if they hear it.
No.
We can't hear it. We cannot hear it.
Okay, I got to try something else. Always a possibility. Hold on. And let me go back here and... maybe this will do it. Let me try again.
Dr. Sokolow, there is a button when you share screen.
Pardon?
Hey there.
Yep, you got it. You got it.
Yeah. Okay, somewhat repetitive. Here's a slightly different version that at least incorporates some more of the words.
Hey.
Now, the curious thing, by the way, two things to note about the song itself. The first is that it seems to be constructed along the lines of one of the piyutim that we might recognize from the Haggadah. That is to say, it moves along in the alphabetic order, right? It's built according to the acrostic of the Aleph Bet. And as you can see, there are also, let me just get it back up. Okay. Atlit with an Aleph, Be'er Yaakov with a Bet. Okay. Ben Shemem, Gidera with a Gimel, Deganya with a Dalet, right? Hartuv with a Hey. So it's constructed, it's somewhat reminiscent of Adirhu Yivneh Veito Bikarov, Bimheira Biyamenu Bikarov, El Bnei, the notion of building, Yivneh, right? It's somewhat reminiscent of that Haggadah song. But
what
a curious thing,
Atlit mean?
This is
what does
the first
Atlit
time
mean?
I'm trying to come across this, is that there's also a little bit of poetic license here. Actually, the place of Atlit, right, in the Galilee, is actually spelled with an ayin. But it appears that at least when the song was put together in the last decade of the 19th century, there was not yet any place in Israel that began with an aleph. So since they already had an ayin, they had Ein Ganim, and they had Ekron, so they took some poetic license and they spelled Atlit with an aleph in order to have a complete aleph bet.
What about Ashkelon, Ashdod? Let's begin with
Ashdod. There were no Jews living there.
Oh, okay, interesting.
There were no Jews living there at that time. So they seem to have limited it to places that were already being settled by Jews. So as I said, it would seem that there really is no other way in which to account for it. They didn't make a mistake in spelling.
Which year would these songs be from? These the 30s? Hi.
No, as I said, it can be traced back. It can be traced back all the way to 1884.
Oh, okay.
But it again, like many songs and like many piyutim, it also grew by accretion over time.
Okay.
I do want to make just one comment about Ekron. Now, if there were Ekron, if you may recall from your Bible, was one of the five cities of the Philistines. Right? The original five towns, if you'll pardon me, were Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, Gat, and Aza. Okay? At the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century, as I mentioned, there were no Jews yet living in Ashdod or in Ashkelon, and certainly not for that matter in Aza, though there had been Jews living in Aza in the Middle Ages during the Ottoman period.
My neighbor's family, I believe, was in Aza at that time.
But there, in 1884, there were already Jews living in Ekron. The place in which they were living, which when they moved into it was called Ekron, its name was subsequently changed. It's now called Mazkeret Batya. Mazkeret Batya was named for one of the great ladies of the Rothschild family, since the settlement in Ekron was financed by the Rothschilds. The interesting thing about the settlement in Ekron is that it was the first of its kind in the history of Jewish settlement, modern Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. Previously, pioneers who came to Israel had to learn agriculture. That's why one of the first places in Israel to be built up in the 19th century was an agricultural school in Mikveh Yisrael. And that's where people would go in order to learn the rudiments of agriculture before they set out for wherever they were going to settle. At some point, somebody had the great idea, why do we have to bring people to Israel who have absolutely no idea what farming is like, and then we have to invest time and money and effort in teaching them how to farm? Why don't we bring Jewish farmers to Israel? So at one point, a group of 10 Jewish farmers was organized. It was organized by Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver, one of the fathers of religious Zionism, one of the early leaders of the Bilu movement. And he organized this group of 10 Jewish farmers, and they settled in Ekron. Now, the interesting thing is not even so much that this is, as I said, you know, the first time that a village of Jewish farmers was established in the land of Israel, but Rabbi Mulliver had a concern, and his concern was, what would these Jewish religious farmers do during the Shemitah year? Right? His concern was that, as it was, they were able to barely make a subsistence living. And the concern was that during the year of Shemitah, he was afraid that, you know, that their settlement would just simply come apart. So it was on behalf of these Jewish religious farmers that Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver approached Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, one of the Torah giants of Eastern Europe in the late 19th century, and secured on their behalf what today is called the Heter Mechira. That is to say, the sanction.
Excuse me, there's a whole book written about
in Israel during the Shemitah year so that people could continue to cultivate it. So it was for these farmers in Ekron that Rabbi Mulliver and Rabbi Spector produced this Heter Mechira. But the curious thing was that by the time the Heter Mechira was issued, these farmers had come under the influence of the Edah Haredit in Yerushalayim, and they were persuaded by the rabbis in the Edah Haredit of Yerushalayim not to abide by the Heter Mechira. So it's somewhat ironic that the people on whose behalf the Heter Mechira was originally secured were the first ones not to use it. Okay.
Where did you bring them from? Where were they from?
To the Baron and his officers were supporting Heter Mechira, but the Maskeret Bakken people gave it to a family.
I don't know if anybody heard you because I didn't either. You want to start again, please?
I reviewed that book. What happened was the Baron and his officials were supporting only Heter Mechira. And when the Maskeret Batya people said it's not good enough for us, they ran into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, basically that's it. So as I said, that was just something apropos of the appearance of Ekron. Okay. Moving along. And again, I'm trying to abide by a strict chronological timeline. So from 1884, we come to 1890. In 1890, we have a poetic composition by Chaim Nachman Bialik, one of his very earliest poems, called El HaTzipor. You may know, it's an interesting fact of natural geography, that the land of Israel is on one of the world's principal bird migration lanes. I don't know the numbers, the hundreds of thousands, millions of birds pass in the vicinity of the land of Israel annually. I don't think Bialik was particularly aware of this, but he certainly knew that in the winter, birds went south and came back again in the spring. So literary fictitious assumption that one of those birds returning to Eastern Europe in the spring had gone as far as the land of Israel, Bialik wrote a poem to the bird, El HaTzipor. As you see the opening lines, Shalom Rav Shuvech Tzipora Nechmedet, right? Welcome back, darling bird, Me'artzot HaChom, returning from the warmer lands, El Chaloni to my window, El Kolechi Arev to your pleasant voice, Ma Nafshi Chalata, how much I missed it, Bachoref, during the winter, Bo'ozvech Me'oniv, when you left these parts. And he asks the bird to bring him specific regards from the land of Israel. Now, I'm going to play you a rendition of this poem by the famous Israeli songstress Nechama Hendel, but I want you to pay particular attention to the way in which she pronounces the words, because this is something that we're going to see time and again when we look at early Hebrew songs. Many, maybe most, of the really early Hebrew songs were written by Jews who grew up in Eastern Europe and who were accustomed to the Ashkenazic pronunciation of Hebrew. Not merely the Ashkenazic pronunciation of Hebrew, meaning that they pronounced a sov as a sov and a komets as a komets, rather than as the Sephardic pronunciation would have it, but their intonation, their accentuation was typical of the cheder, okay? Which means that over time, two things happened to many, most, or maybe at some point even all of these songs. They began to be sung by people who, first of all, used the Sephardi rather than the Ashkenazi pronunciation, which means that Savs were pronounced Tav and Kametzim were pronounced Ah. But the second more striking change is that words started to be accented correctly rather than the way that they had been accented in the Cheder. The ordinary rule in Hebrew, the rule of thumb in Hebrew, is that Hebrew words, generally speaking, are what we call milara. That is to say that the accent is on the final syllable. The exceptions to the rule are what we call mila'el, where the accent is on the penultimate syllable, the next to the last syllable. The traditional Eastern European Jewish pronunciation, right, tended to regard most words as being mila'el. Modern Hebrew, following the Sephardic tradition, recognizes, as I said, that most words are actually milara. So instead of shalom rab shuvech tzipora nechemedet, what you really have is that Bialik, when he wrote the poem, he was thinking of shalom rab shuvech tzipora nechemedes, which not only is a different intonation, as you can sense, it preserves a rhyme, right? Kind of like iambic pentameter, an alternation of stressed and unstressed syllables. Obviously, if you're going to impose a rhyme scheme on a Hebrew sentence, you know, it's just inevitable that you're going to, you know, to technically mispronounce certain words. So again, here is Nechama Hendel in her rendition of this poem. Coming through? Good.
Shalom rav shuvech tzipora nechemedes me'aretzot ha'chomel chaloni el kolech ki arev manafshi kalata b'choref בחורף ועוזבך מאוד hayered kifnini mehatal ale har feremon im yered vei por kidema u maslo mehayered ne u meima ve habidim u shlome kole
So again, just a couple of points to make about this poem. In the second stanza, you see that he asks the bird in particular whether even in distant lands, Tirbena ha-ra'ot ha-tla'ot. Remember that Bialik, right, lived through some of the more striking instances of oppression of Jews in the Pale of Settlement and elsewhere in Eastern Europe and in Russia, right? Here's his famous poem about Ir HaHarega, about Kishinev. Okay. So what you have here is that Bialik is asking, you know, basically he's asking the bird to tell him, is it bad? Is it as bad elsewhere, right, as it is here at home? Okay. And then, of course, it gets a little more, it gets a little brighter. And he asks specifically in the last stanza that we heard, he makes specific reference to places in the land of Israel. He mentions Har Hermon, right, which, of course, is mentioned already in the Torah. He mentions the Yarden. He talks about the Harim and the Gevaot, etc. And the very final stanza, right, Kvar Kalu Hadmaot, right, that you know, we're kind of exhausted, our tears have exhausted. Kvar Kalu HaKitzim, all of the times in which we anticipated our exile to end have come and gone. V'lo HeKitz HaKetz Al Yegoni, and yet there seems to be no end, he says, to my torment, to my distress. So once again, he addresses the bird and he says, Shalom Rav Shuvech, welcome back, Tzipori HaYikara, dear bird, Sahalina Kolech Varoni, at least let's take this opportunity to rejoice.
If I could just add something parenthetically, in more recent times, the Ethiopian Jews who recognized this migration pattern wrote a song in Amharic asking the birds who came about the what was going on in Jerusalem and praying, how is Jerusalem from which you are returning, and praying for its welfare.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. My pleasure.
Now, finally come to a oldie but goodie, Tikvateinu. Better, of course, and more widely recognized as HaTikva, but of course there are some differences. Not only is Tikvateinu a lengthier poem than HaTikva, but here again for the first time we see where the texts of certain of these poems or old songs were altered on account of changing circumstances. Okay. The poem, as you can see, if you can see the top line, right? The original name of the poem was Tikvateinu, Our Hope. Okay. And it was written by Naftali Hertz Imber. Imber, lived from 1856 to 1909. And between the years 1878 and 1884, he published several collections of his poems. So this is a poem that he himself worked on over an extended period of time. Okay. So probably even when he finally published it, and we can take a quick look at one of its first public appearances, he probably would have acknowledged that it was still a work in progress. So the fact that today we sing it to words that he didn't write is not at all, you know, an offense to him as the original poet. But as I said, it would be rather like extending his authorship to a more logical conclusion. You can certainly see embodied in the opening paragraphs of the poem the nucleus of what became the Zionist and the Israeli, and some would even call it the Jewish national anthem, HaTikvah. Okay. First of all, we have to invert the sequence of the first two stanzas. Okay. When Imber first published the poem, it began, Od lo avada tikvatenu, our hope has not ended. Which hope? HaTikvah hanoshana, right? Our ancient hope. And what is that hope? Lashuv le'eretz avotenu, to be able to return to our ancestral land, Le'ir ba David Hanan, specifically to David's city, to Jerusalem. I know that the text here says Mishuv, but I didn't want to tamper with the text as it appears on the website in case anybody would make a comparison. But there is considerable evidence that, again, of all of the different versions of the poem that Imber himself produced, that the one that seems to have taken hold was not Mishuv, but Lashuv, to return. In fact, I heard from people in my grandparents' generation that when Zionist meetings were held, at the end of the meeting, people would say Lomir Zingen Loshov, that they would end the meeting by singing the Hatikva. And since it wasn't yet called the HaTikvah, because that is only the name that it was given when it became a national anthem, the nickname that they had for it was Lashuv, from the line Lashuv le'eretz avoteinu. And again, the second stanza is the one that remains pretty much intact. Kol od bilavavo sham penima, as long as within him, nefesh yehudi homiyah, the soul of a Jew is in turmoil, ulefate mizrach kadima, and towards east, eino litzion sofia, his eye, he's constantly looking towards Zion. But the poem, of course, goes beyond that. It originally had 9 stanzas, and it has had a different number of stanzas, as I said, depending upon which of the published versions one follows. I'd like to do something interesting here. 2 things. One, share a little bit of information about the origin of the name of the poem, Tikvatenu. Imber was not a religious Jew, but he was an educated Jew. And Imber was acquainted with these verses in the book of Yechezkel. This is the end of the famous vision of Yechezkel known as the dry bones, in which he goes out to a valley that's filled with dry bones, and the bones come together and they're dressed up in flesh, and wind comes and inspires them, and they come back to life. And as we see, the first of the verses brought down here, V'hinabeti kasher tzivani, I prophesied as God instructed me, Vatavo bahem haruach vayichyu, and the wind entered into these skeletons and brought them back to life. Vayamidu al raglehem, and they arose. Chayil gadol ma'od ma'od, a vast multitude. Vayomer elai, and God says to the prophet Yechezkel, Ben Adam, ha'atzamot ha'elo, who are these dry bones? Kol Beit Yisrael hema. They represent the house of Israel. They are the Jewish people. But why are there dry bones? Because, hinei omrim, because they said, or they thought of themselves, yabishu atzmotenu, our bones are dry, meaning we lack vitality, we lack the essence of life, avidatik vatenu, our hope for salvation, our hope for redemption, right? Avidah is lost, nigzaru lanu, right? And our fate has been sealed. We are doomed. Therefore, God says to the prophet, Hinaveh, what is the subject of your prophecy? The object of your prophecy, Amarta Elohim, this is a message you should deliver to the house of Israel. Ko amar Hashem Elohim, this is the word of God. Hinei ani foteach et kivroteichem. If you think of yourselves as just skeletons, God, as it were, is going to open your tombs, and he will take you out of your tombs, right? This is obviously a metaphor for Jewish life in the diaspora, in the exile, right? God will take them out of the exile. Ve'heveti etchem el admat Yisrael. And he will restore them to the land of Israel. This is the origin of the title Tikvatenu. And you can see that it even incorporates the phrase Avida Tikvatenu. So in opposition to the people of whom Yechezkel prophesied, who thought that they were doomed, and who described their doom as Avida Tikvatenu, hope for redemption is gone, he specifically, Davka, entitled his poem Tikvatenu and introduced in it at the very beginning the line, Od lo avada tikvatenu, that indeed, in truth, our hope has not yet vanished. I want to very quickly just share with you three things. You can do this on your own on the website. The link is here. Okay. You can hear renditions of HaTikva. Of course, there are scores of renditions of HaTikva. But three that really struck me as being significant, being singular. One was by Moshe Kusevitzky, arguably the greatest Chazan of his age, right? As a kid in Borough Park, I had the opportunity to hear him in Beth El Synagogue on Shabbat Mevarchim, okay? So one is Moshe Kusevitzky. The second is, of course, the great tenor, Richard Tucker. And the third is a curiosity, Al Jolson, okay, who, of course, got his role in the jazz singer because he was the son of a chazan. Okay, so those are three renditions of HaTikva that you can obtain on your own. Okay. But one that I think you might be particularly interested in, and I will share it with you, is this one. Not what you might have expected.
In 1886, I found out, titled Tikvatenu, which means our hope. It's deeply moving words are a prayer which suggests that as long as the heart within a Jewish soul still yearns, hope is never lost. So tonight, this very special occasion, I sing this with the continued hope that we may learn from yesterday, live for today, and continue to strive for a better tomorrow. Feel free to join me as I say your beautiful national anthem. Probably the most beautiful one I've ever heard.
Said the links are there. If you want to hear it again, you're certainly welcome to do it. So let me just move us back. Okay. Now this is what you've all been waiting for. Finally, a song that actually has the word Chalutzim in the title. The interesting thing is that I never knew that it was called Shira Chalutzim until I started investigating it. I only knew it by the opening line. If you can't see the opening line clearly here, it's much clearer here. On this page, this is actually the first time that it ever appeared in print. It appeared in a journal called Hapoel HaTzair, because it was a workman's song. Okay. I thought that just, you know, to share with you the original, I only knew it from its opening words, which I knew actually not as Anu Nihiyeh HaRishonim, but as Anu Nihiyeh HaRishonim. When I first heard it, when I first learned it, I learned it in its original Ashkenazic version. And it was only when I started searching for it online that I discovered that it actually had a title, it actually had a name, and that its official name was actually Shir HaChalutzim. It was composed during the construction of the Afula Nazareth Road, and it was written to mark the fact that this was the first time that Jewish laborers were hired to do road work as opposed to Arab laborers. It appeared in print in 1920. So apparently that's when it was written, early on in the first year, perhaps, of the British mandate, right? The British employed Arabs and also Jews in a variety of what we would call infrastructure projects. So this is one that appeared first in 1920. It would appear that the tune was borrowed from a Yiddish workers' song that was well known at the time, and therefore people could simply take a well-known tune and could adapt it to the new words. It expresses some of what we've come to see as typifying, as characteristic of the chalutzim, of the pioneering society. And let me get the. This is rather curious because this actually was sung by the official Israeli Army choir, the Lahakat Sahal. So it's curious to hear, you know, but they understood that they couldn't sing it the way they might have read it. They had to sing it the way it was intended to be sung originally. Just a couple of points about it. As you can see, the background of building a road comes through in the words. It comes through very clearly in the third paragraph, the last one that they sang, Anu Nasola Takvishim, we're the ones who are going to pave the roads. Nachtsob Tsurlav Negir, we're going to, as it were, carve the roads through the mountains, right? Heidad Yanu Apatishim, the hammers, the jackhammers, right, will all celebrate. Bishirenu Etashir, as we sing the song. But it's already there really in the first stanza. Neit hametar, neit anach. Neit is arguably the imperative of the verb lintot, to reach out. Nete, instead of biblical Hebrew, would be Nete, right? So here they have Nate. A metar, which also means a chord, a string on a guitar or on a violin, is obviously a measuring device. And the anach is the plumb line. So what we have a reference to in the opening stanza, the metar and the anach, are obviously the surveyor's tools that that drew the lines for the road that they then had to carve its way through the rocks. So here we finally at least have come to what is at least a shir chalutzim. Now, I'll tell you in all candor, since this really is a new venture, I had no idea when I started out just, you know, how much time it would take, how much of the songs to play, etc. I see that we're already close to the closing time, and there are a lot of things on the chat that I have to look through. So there are several items that we didn't cover that are part of today's source sheets, but we'll somehow incorporate them into subsequent classes. So let me take a quick look here at the chat and see what I can respond to. Oh, I see there are some recommendations here. I will certainly take note of them.
Dr. Sokolow, Dr. Sokolow?
Yes.
You don't need to write those down. I'll copy the chat for you and I'll send it to you in an email.
Oh, thank you. Okay. So let me just then look through what if there are specific questions. Yes, Kiryat Ekron is not near Mazkeret Batya. Mazkeret Batya was Ekron. If there is now a place called Kiryat Ekron in addition to it, then just somebody capitalized on the name. Yes, Rebels in the Holy Land is the book. Somebody said they actually reviewed it. This is the book that tells somewhat of a lengthy story. Tells the story of these 10 pioneering farming families in what came to become Mazkeret Batya, in which there actually is still a synagogue on the name of Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver in recognition of his important role in getting them there. As I said, Naftali Herzimber was not a religious Jew, but he certainly was an educated one. My grandfather actually knew him. Imber died in 1909 while living in New York City. In fact, he was originally buried in Mount Zion Cemetery in Queens. In 1953, in recognition of his being the author of the Hatikva, his body was reinterred in Jerusalem, but he did live for a while in the United States. Smetana's Moldau. There is still to this very day a machloket as to who made the shidduch between the tune and the words. And again, there's a pshat answer and a drash answer. One answer is that this was a well-known Romanian folk tune. And since a lot of the people living in Israel at the time of the early pioneers came from Romania, they just simply did it themselves. Okay. Another story that I heard from someone who was born, someone who was the first generation born in Petah Tikva, told me that, again, because of Smetana's Moldau, because of the existence of this tune as a Romanian folk tune, it was used on the Yamim HaNoraim and the Shalosh Regalim in Petach Tikva for Vahavienu Litzion Yircha. Right? Vahavienu Litzion Yircha, Litzion Yircha Berina. And therefore, since the tune had already made its way into something that was reminiscent of the return to Zion, that's what influenced it becoming the tune of Hatikva. But if you look on the website, you'll find a link to a segment of a Romanian movie, right, in which there is a song called The Ox Cart. And if you ignore the Romanian words and listen only to the tune, it's not Smetna's Moldau. It's not just the recording. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Not just that. It's Hatikva note by note. So there's that. Okay. Wow. 16 350 3rd Street. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. Well, like your parents, Debbie, my parents, you know, were Hashomer Adati, Apoel HaMizrahi. So again, you know, I love these songs because of the songs that I, you know, that I heard as a kid. But before we leave for today, I also want to make another confession. And that is that it wouldn't have occurred to me to attempt this if I hadn't read this book over the fall. It's a rather remarkable book. It's called Shir Hu Lo Rak Milim, which actually are the words of a song, right? There's a song called Shir Hu Lo Rak Milim, right? Songs are not only words. It's written by a very well respected Israeli historian named David Asaf. And he has a blog called Erev Shabbat. And occasionally in his Erev Shabbat blog, he investigated the roots of some of these Hebrew songs. And eventually he put, about 15 of them together into a book. And I was so taken with the book. I so enjoyed reading it that that's basically what gave me the stimulated me to put all these songs together and to share them with you. So once again, thank you all for joining us today on this pioneering voyage into pioneering songs. And I look forward to seeing all of you, or as many of you as possible, next Tuesday at 11 o'clock. Shira, back to you.
Dr. Sokolow, hi. I just got on.
Oh, Rabbi Kalman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just heard the last 2 minutes that I saw the comments. So fascinating. Everybody enjoyed it. So I'll have to listen later. But anyways, I just wanted to say hello and welcome back. Thank you. So Yashar Koach. But nice. I guess we didn't do any singing today, actual singing, but that's okay.
Well, I heard that people will sing along on their own when the music is playing.
That's it. As long as they're muted, they can sing as much as they want.
Exactly.
Okay. Anyway, thank you.
I want to tell you, I enjoyed so much as someone who was 7th generation from Jerusalem. I know really all the songs, and it really touched my heart. It's beautiful. Thank you so much.
She could probably sing. Her husband, of course, was a great chazan, world-class chazan. So I don't know what your voice is like, Ruchama, but anyway.
Yeah, it's just like amazing, yes. I enjoyed all the songs. I know them. It means so much to me. It's history. Our songs are history, not just words. It's history.
Thank you very much, Rabbi, and Toda Rabba.
Okay, thank you. Rabbi Shulman is in 1 hour on Sefer Daniel. And then the Rabbi Helfgott is not speaking this week. Our regular shiurim during the week, Rabbi Daniel Friedman will give the Parsha shiur on Thursday, and then my shiur on the Siddur on Friday. Tomorrow, Lindsay Guhartz will be speaking her series on Christianity, and Rabbi Levine continuing part two on development of the Shomer Chanuch. Next week, we'll have a few new series that are beginning. I mentioned last night. Rabbi Liebtag, of course, will start a new series on chronology in the Bible. When in the Torah is not in chronology, and Adam Mintz will be giving a 4-part series on the history of the Erev, including that's what he wrote his PhD thesis on. He just came out with the book on the history of Erevim, and he will give, of course, a talk for those who live in Toronto. One of his 4 talks will be on the history of the Toronto Eruv. And I'm happy to announce, we'll send you details that in the near future, Shuli Mishkan will be back giving another series. So we got lots going on here, and hope to learn with you. And I don't know, Shir, if you want to say anything, but I'm going to go back to school. And everybody have a wonderful day. Hope to see you soon. And thank you, Dr. Sokolow. Okay.
Thank you. Dr. Sokolow, do you think that there's any communist influence in any of the songs? The one of the road builders sounds very much like a song to a tractor.
We'll get there. We'll get there. Yes, indeed. There is very pronounced communist influence on some of the songs. We'll get some of them, in fact, are actually Russian songs, socialist songs that were translated into Hebrew, or some passed through Yiddish on their way to Hebrew. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Dr. Sokolo, I see Paul. Paul has his hand up. Paul, are you still there? Do you have a question before we go?
Well, maybe he's just waving, so I'll wave back.
Paul, now's your chance. We're about Paul to end the meeting.
Okay.
Okay. The blog is called, David Asaf's blog is called Oneg Shabbat, not Erev Shabbat.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
But it comes out on Friday.
Thank
Correct.
You.
Correct. It's excellent.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks to everyone for being here. We look forward to seeing you here same time next week.
Have a good week.
Shavua Tov. Thank you, Dr. Sokolo. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Great.